Returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on AccessSacramento.org, I'm Steve Lerman. We start out today's program with coal exports. This short segment is about U.S. coal companies wanting to build export facilities in the Pacific Northwest to ship coal to Asia. And then the next segment is Cities of the Future. Anna Lee Newitz talks about death-proofing a city and converting urban space into biological organisms to prevent starvation and environmental destruction due to global climate change. She's interviewed by Greta Bronner of C-SPAN. And then we finish up with a short piece on India's coal is killing thousands.
The governors of Oregon and Washington State are asking President Obama's environmental team to weigh in on controversial plans to export coal from federal lands in Montana and Wyoming to markets in Asia. Governors John Kitzhaber of Oregon and Jay Inslee of Washington, both Democrats, have sent a letter to the White House asking the government to consider costs to the climate and taxpayers as it reviews plans to build port facilities and rail lines. Amelia Templeton from Oregon Public Broadcasting and the public radio collaborative EarthFix has been reporting on this story and joins us now to discuss the governor's letter. Hi there, Amelia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Glad to have you on the program. So to be clear, the governors of Washington State and Oregon are not asking to block the export of coal from federal land. They're simply raising questions?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, they're bluntly not in a position to block the export of coal from federal lands. But they're asking for, first, a careful accounting of how much the government charges coal companies for the coal that we sell off of federal lands. They're asking for a clear accounting of the climate change consequences of choosing to export this coal and building the infrastructure that will make that happen. And they're kind of warning the federal government. They essentially say, you know, these decisions will dwarf any other decisions we make regarding climate change, and it will be very difficult to credibly go to the international community and say that we are fighting climate change while continuing to make federal coal available this way.
So the governors are saying that the resulting carbon dioxide, that is global warming emissions from these coal exports, would amount to some 240 million tons per year. How accurate do you think that assessment of some 240 million tons a year might be?
It's a little hard to say. We put that question to an expert, and he came up with about 175 million tons a year, so a little lower than the governor's estimate. Greenpeace has come up with its own estimate, a little higher, 280 million tons a year. But just to put all those numbers in perspective, that's greater than the total emissions of Oregon and Washington combined for a year. So they're all pretty big numbers. They're all very significant emissions. And right now, the Council on Environmental Quality recommends that any project with greater direct emissions than 25,000 tons of carbon dioxide a year should be looked at for its climate impacts. And so it's about, you know, 1,000 times the threshold of what should trigger this kind of review.
There's a lot of talk about Keystone. Is this a bigger deal than Keystone, do you think?
Some environmental groups are now coming out and saying this is a bigger deal than Keystone. I know Greenpeace has done some accounting, and they have identified these proposals taken collectively as one of the greatest climate decisions that this country will make. So that's certainly, Kitzhaber and Inslee aren't the only people to have come to that conclusion.
The letter claims that the way things are now structured, the U.S. would actually be subsidizing the export of coal to Asia. Is that a fair assessment of what they're saying, and is that a fair assessment of the situation?
I think that's definitely a fair assessment of what they're saying. The governors explain that the federal government owns some of the largest coal reserves in the world, and they allege that the federal government may be pricing that coal too low, and that if we do export that coal, that will translate into a subsidy for coal-fired power generation in Asia.
How much influence do you think the governors can have on these issues?
I don't know. I think what we've seen is they've been very influential in shining a light on the potential climate impacts of these terminals, and I think they've certainly been influential in encouraging debate. I'm not sure how much influence they have over the ultimate permitting decisions. That really rests with the Army Corps of Engineers and the federal government.
How much do you think that this letter from these two governors reflects the concerns of Washington and Oregon residents?
I think Washington and Oregon residents are certainly concerned about climate change, and we have seen just in the last year some really massive forest and range fires that have a lot of people concerned. One prediction for our region is that changing climate may increase the size and frequency of wildfire. We have major concerns with dams and with water storage in the region that will be impacted by climate change. On the flip side, though, polls have shown pretty significant support for these coal export proposals and pretty significant support, you know, on the basis of the jobs that they'll create and the economic activity that they'll bring to our region.
Amelia Templeton is a journalist with Oregon Public Broadcasting and the public radio collaborative EarthFixed. She's based in Medford, Oregon. Thank you so much, Amelia, for taking this time.
Thank you.
EarthFixed has been gathering public opinions on both sides of the fierce debate about export plans for the Voices of Coal project. Here are a couple of those voices.
I'm Richard Burkholder, and I'm one of the owners at Spinrail Dune Buggy.
Hi, my name is Tanya Burkholder. I'm also an owner here at Spinrail Dune Buggy, North Bend, Oregon, just south of Lakeside. Our house is right here next to our business, and the train tracks run probably 100 feet, maybe, behind our house. So we hear the train.
They've always had a commercial type of train coming through, whether it's logging, whether it's gravel, dirt. With the coal train coming through that they're wanting to do, it's just another product. We have over 60 miles of these dunes along the coast. We have a wide variety of wildlife. There's residential areas. There's play areas. They train Iditarod dogs here. They do all types of stuff in the dunes. A coal terminal is not going to affect tourism. We're still going to see the business. We're going to see the people coming through. It's not in a position where it's going to hurt the dunes. It's not in a position, I believe, where it's going to hurt the environment. And if it will impact our business as far as if the community grows and economically it's strong and sound, more people are going to come in here.
It's a tourism-driven community, really. I think it would be nice to have an additional revenue booster in this area. I am from Montrose, which is in western Colorado, right in the middle of a lot of coal. A lot to me growing up there. It was just a part of life. There was a lot of people that my family knew that had jobs that were related to the coal industry. I saw coal trains a lot, but I really don't think there's a lot of negative about it. I think that there's probably more positive, and I think that having it here would be a positive thing for this community.
The terminal is going to provide jobs. It'll bring in ships. It brings in sailors on those ships who spend money in town. They walk the boardwalk. They go to the restaurants. You drive down through Coos Bay right now. Look at how many buildings are empty. Look at how many businesses that used to be there are empty. With a coal terminal, put aside the coal. It's business.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Well, I'm going to preach all a sermon about old man Adam, and I don't mean the Adam in the Bible, Adam. No, I don't mean the Adam that Mother Eve made it. I mean the thing that science liberated. The thing that Einstein says he's scared of, and when Einstein's scared, brother, I'm scared. Well, if you're scared of the A-bomb, here's what you got to do. You got to gather all the people in the world with you, because if we don't get together and do it, well, the first thing you know, we'll blow this world plumb to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini. Now, life used to be such a simple joy. The cyclotron was just a super toy. And folks got born, they'd work and marry. And atom was a word in the dictionary. And then it happened. And the science boys from every clime, they all pitched in with overtime. And before they knew it, the job was done. And they'd hitched up the power of the gall-darned sun and put a harness on old Sol, splitting atoms. While the diplomats was a-splitting hairs. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini. But the Adams International, in spite of hysteria, flourishes in Utah and in Siberia. And whether you're black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. And the answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there fastest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta stick together or disintegrate. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, bloody up the flu, Alamogordo, Bikini. It could happen to you. Yes, it's up to the people, because the Adam don't care, and you can't fence him in, he's just like air, and he doesn't give a hoot about any politics or who got what into whichever fix, because all he wants to do is just sort of set around and have his nucleus bombarded by neutrons. So the moral is this, just as plain as day, that old man Adam is here to stay. He's gonna stick around, that's clear to see. But ah, my dearly beloved, are we? So listen, folks, here is my thesis. Peace in the world, or the world in peace. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini.
Today we're joined by Annalee Newitz. She is in San Francisco a very early morning to talk about her recent piece for Discover magazine based on a new book. And Annalee Newitz, the book is Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. And then the headline in your piece in Discover magazine is How to Death Proof a city. Mass extinction, death proof. Why use these words? What's the evidence that we're headed in that direction?
So there have been several mass extinctions already in Earth's history. And these are events where more than 75% of species on the planet die out over a period of about a million years, which is very short in geological time. It's obviously quite long in human time. And most of these mass extinctions have been caused by climate change. And so there's a lot of evidence mounting now that humans may be about to enter a new mass extinction. The whole planet may be about to enter a new phase of mass extinction. Partly the proof is that we're seeing climate changes. Part of the proof is we're seeing elevated extinction levels among animals. So we're seeing more animals going extinct than we might expect over the past couple of centuries. So the evidence is mounting that we are looking down the barrel of this kind of disaster. And the question is, how should we as humans respond? And that's part of what I'm interested in tackling.
And you write in the Discover piece, which is based on your new book, to safeguard the future of our increasingly urban species, our cities must be sturdier, healthier, and more alive. You call them a biological city. What do you mean?
So what I'm talking about is the fact that cities are a place where most people will be living over the next coming centuries. Right now, already over half the world's population lives in cities. The UN estimates that by 2050, 67% of the world's population will be living in cities, and those numbers are much bigger for developed countries. Cities are also, in the United States, the source of a huge amount of our GDP. Some estimate up to 85% of the GDP is produced by cities. So these are very important areas to focus on if we want to see the future of humanity progress. And so one of the proposals that I make, and that a lot of scientists and urban designers and architects are making as well, is that we need to be pushing our cities toward being more survivable. And that can mean something as simple as being prepared for disasters like earthquakes and floods and mudslides. And that can mean re-engineering buildings that already exist, making emergency evacuation plans more widely available to the populace so people know what to do. But looking toward the far future, which is one of the things I do in my work, you also are looking at changing the very materials that we make cities out of. And that's where the biological city idea comes in. Because right now, in research labs across the country and around the world, we're seeing the development of what are called self-healing or smart materials. Things like cement that can heal itself, metal coatings that can heal themselves. And the idea is to create cities that are sustainable because we don't have to keep knocking things down and building new things. We actually have structures that are robust against damage, but also robust against the ravages of time. And again, looking toward the future, part of this biological city will also involve new kinds of fuels, like, say, biofuels that might be grown in and around cities.
So we're talking with Annalee Newitz about her Discover magazine article, which is based on her new book. If you want to call in with your comments or your questions, Republicans 202-585-3881, Democrats 202-585-3880, and Independents, all others, 202-585-3882. We'll get to your questions and comments here in just a second. Annalee Newitz, I was just about to ask you, so will our cities look any different than they do now?
So that's a really good question. When you're looking ahead to, say, 50 years from now, if we start using more biomaterials and self-healing materials, probably cities would look a lot the way they do now. But the difference would be if, say, a bridge developed a crack, that crack would seal itself up. So you might start to see little scars on your bridges or on your buildings. But over time, say, looking 150 years out, which again, it's a far horizon, but that is kind of the horizon that we're looking at with some of the science today, you might start to see cities that look like they're covered in vines or covered in algae, because there's a very good chance that the cornerstone of the future city might be something like a genetically engineered algae that could do anything from provide fuel to provide water purification and even provide lighting. So instead of burning fossil fuels to have your lights on at night, you might just have algae that glows at night. So cities might start to look something like a ruin. So outside you'd have algae and these kind of puckered, scarred concrete, but inside you'd have like high-tech internet and total access to really awesome developed technology. So, you know, it looks very natural on the outside, but we would still have all of our modern conveniences on the inside.
And the title of the Peace and Discover magazine is How to Death-Proof a City. To safeguard the future of our increasingly urban species, our cities must be sturdier, healthier, and more alive. And the book by Annalee New, it's a new book called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Our guest with over a decade's experience in writing about science, culture, and the future, as many of you have probably guessed from listening to her. And you're also the founding editor of a science website, io9.com, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And what can people find there?
Io9 covers futuristic science and pop culture, so you can find everything from stories about the latest scientific innovations to the latest Star Trek movie.
Let's get to our first phone call. Robert in Jonesboro, Arkansas, independent caller. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm interested in knowing how Annalee could revive a city like Detroit, Michigan, which is already dying from within. It has lost over half its population since about 1980, and I've noticed grave urban decay in that city over the last couple of decades. How would she resolve that situation for Detroit in particular?
It's a good question. I mean, Detroit is always given as the example of a classic city in decline. And it is the case that if you look at how cities function over the long term, and you look at a city like, for example, Istanbul, which has existed for thousands of years, the way that a city survives for a very long time is by constantly changing not just its urban layout, but also the kinds of economic production that it engages in. It changes the relationships it has with other cities and other nations around it. So Detroit, in the short term, is looking at some pretty tough times. But I think that over the long term, what will have to happen is Detroit will need to have new industries develop in order to revitalize the city and develop new relationships with the cities around it. And it's not something that can happen overnight, and it has to be part of a long-term plan for revitalizing that city. But of course, like I said, it always comes back to cities have to be flexible when it comes to the kinds of industries that they are promoting and that they are cultivating. And just like an ecosystem needs diversity, cities also need diversity in terms of their economic productivity. And one of the problems with Detroit has been that it has been focused very heavily on one particular industry. And so the first thing that needs to happen is diversification.
Annalee Newitz, what's the role of the government in safeguarding the cities, as you say, preventing the mass extinction of urban areas?
So I think the role of the government is twofold. One is, I feel, the role of the government to put money into organizations like the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy to allow scientists to do the kind of really fundamental basic research that will allow us in 50 years or 100 years to lose our dependence on fossil fuels, lose our dependence on materials that are heavily polluting and that have awful byproducts. But I think also it's the government's role to participate in coming up with better city planning. And that city planning is everything from how the city is designed for people to how the city invests in businesses. And I think I don't mean to say that the government should control all the businesses in a city. I just mean that part of the government's role should be to help nurture that economic diversity, and that should be part of the city's long-term plan. And there should never be a plan that we depend on one particular type of way for people to make a living.
You write about in your book, and it's featured in the Discover magazine piece, about a subterranean city. Can you explain?
Oh, oh, over and over, we tried to get our message through. Over and over, what more can we do? Over and over, we've been shut down. It's all, over and over. We'll do what we have to do, 'cause we want speak, co-op democracy, table, co-op democracy, vote, co-op democracy, speak, co-op democracy, table, co-op democracy, vote, co-op democracy. Us got a cause that's true.
This co-op's your co-op, from the aisles of produce to the bulk bins gleaming. We're member owners, our voices matter. This co-op belongs to you and me.
We wanted a boycott, so we read the bylaws. We got the sign-on of 100 members. 4 denied us, refused to live.
My co-op, this co-op's your co-op. From the aisles of produce to the bulk bins gleaming, we're member owners, our voices matter. This co-op belongs to you and me.
The board took over, ignored the bylaws, refused to listen, wouldn't hear our voices.
But we're not stopping till the vote is taken.
Co-op's my co-op, this co-op's your co-op. From the house of produce to the bulletin's gleaming, remember owners, our precious matter.
This co-op belongs to you and me.
Oh yes.
This co-op belongs to you and me.
And now for something completely different.